Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Andy Boyd. Today, I'm speaking with Greg Vargo about his book, Chartist Drama. Greg, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. And this book is out in hardcover now, and it's going to be out in a paperback edition in March. Is that right?
That's right.
All right. Fantastic. So this is an edited volume. You write a long introduction, but it also includes four plays that were performed or published by the Chartist movement. What got you interested in the Chartist movement and in the role of theater within that movement?
Well, it's a long story because my first book is a study of Chartist fiction. So Chartism was this really immense, largest social movement in 19th century Britain. For political and economic reforms centered around universal male suffrage, but it also had this quite wonderful cultural side that included over 100 movement newspapers, lots of literature published, I mean, thousands of poems and many novels. And so I had studied that part of the movement, but actually my interest in Chartist drama arose when I found a play that had been long believed not to be extant, a play about the Newport Rising of 1839, which was the last real mass rebellion in Britain. And a Chartist wrote that play in the wake of the Newport Rising. And most scholars had believed that copies no longer existed, but the Columbia Ware Book Room had a copy. And so kind of finding that play sparked an interest and the more I tugged on it, kind of the larger I saw Chartist dramatic culture was.
Yeah, I was not super familiar with the Chartist movement prior to reading your book. And I was very interested in kind of the combination of very radical rhetoric and tactics combined with a goal that in some ways seems, you know, I don't know, from a more left-wing perspective, kind of reformist, like expanding suffrage is kind of a classic like bourgeois right. And yet the language that they use in these plays is like very, you know, fiery class warfare type language. Is that one of the things that kind of interested you in the Chartist movement?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And there's a lot of tensions and contradictions within the movement. There are different wings of it that are more constitutionalist or more revolutionary. But I think it's helpful to keep in mind at a time when maybe 5% of Britain had the vote, it was seen as a demand to enfranchise all adult men that had the capacity of potentially revolutionizing the whole society. And that was certainly the Chartist vision. I mean, something like a vision for social democracy. They thought once working people had the vote that They could put an end to social austerity that had been imposed recently, cuts to the poor rate. They can make factories safer. They could guarantee people living wages. They could end kind of certain aspects of the British Empire, particularly the active union with Ireland, and a kind of a whole range of ideas. And so the Charter, which was this document with six electoral demands, really became shorthand for a transformed social, economic, political, and cultural world.
Did they achieve most of their demands eventually?
No, I mean, I would have to say they didn't. Although obviously history is long, and there is universal suffrage in Britain today. But the Chartists themselves were defeated, were suppressed by a military force, and other kind of ideological elements. And so the movement kind of began to peter out after 1848, really, was the mm-hmm. last hurrah. The year of European revolutions with whom they made common cause.
Yeah. I'm definitely somebody who always wants to believe that theater can change the world, or can at least play a key role in social movements to change the world. And on that score, this book was really exciting to read. Could you talk a bit about how theater kind of communicated the ideas of the movement, or kind of mobilized people for Chartism?
Yeah. It's just really interesting that the Chartists had this quite extensive literary culture. But then on the other hand, this is a moment when something like half of the people in Britain aren't able to read or write, though literacy rates are kind of notoriously thorny. Theater, for one thing, is an art form that allowed them to reach more people. It was also really the probably the most popular art form in 19th century Britain, a mass cultural art form. But beyond that, theater kind of had a special place as a collaborative art, as an embodied art. It was related to the political theater that the Chartists made in the streets. They really were a movement in Britain, at least, that developed kind of elements of protest movements that we would still recognize, like the mass meeting, the simultaneous meetings or rallies that happen around the country. So they were performing a kind of theater, but I think that they turned to actual stage as a way to have a collaborative art form that could think about what it means to collaborate and to form collectivities.
There was a quite complicated legal apparatus around theater at this time and place that prevented comedies and tragedies from being performed without a license, but other forms like farces could be performed. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So what's kind of fascinating about Chartist theater is it is really coincident with a major milestone in theater history, the passage of the Theater Regulations Act of 1843. So prior to 1843 and for really almost two centuries, there was a monopoly on theaters that could perform the so-called legitimate genres that you just mentioned, drama, tragedy, and comedy. Those regulations were widely flouted and the so-called illegitimate theaters would perform things all the time, would just thumb their nose at the theatrical regulations. They would perform Shakespeare under a slightly altered title or add a little song here or there and call it a burletta. But nevertheless, there were statutory limits and theaters did risk legal action and potentially up to losing their license if they performed within those genres. So it's kind of fascinating that the kind of center play in the collection is a five-act tragedy in verse about the Chartist leader of the Newport Rising. And so that seems to be making a set of cultural claims as well as political ones, like what should be the domain of tragedy and who should have access to it.
And I got the sense that some of those cultural political claims were kind of specifically around Shakespeare. Like you talk about one activist who had memorized all of Hamlet. And it seems to me that like there's a certain way that seems to be saying, like, I am just as good as you, you know, noble person, even though I can't vote, even though I'm not wealthy, I have access to the cultural heritage of Britain and therefore deserve access to the sort of political mechanisms of Britain. Is that kind of part of what's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. And really nicely put. Shakespeare is kind of the people's poet for the Chartists. And I mean, they do kind of scandalous appropriations of him. There's a column in the biggest movement newspaper, the Northern Star, called Chartism from Shakespeare. And they'll just excerpt lines from the play that seem democratic or maybe sometimes that potentially endorse physical force as a potential strategy. There's a real cultural contest of going on about what's the meaning of Shakespeare, and also advancing a set of claims about that working people are represented on the stage and are part of the national culture, should have a set of political rights alongside those cultural ones.
Another part of your introduction that I found quite moving, and I can't quite put my finger on why, is there was a note of one theater company thanking another theater company for loaning them their set to be able to perform one of their plays. Could you give us a sense of kind of what types of venues these plays were performed at and what types of audiences would have seen them?
Yeah, so a huge range of venues, and there are kind of two parts the dramatic culture that I try to illuminate. So on the one hand, there's a set of amateur performances, something like 75% of the over 100 performances I've identified were by amateurs, just members of Chartist groups. And they confront kind of all kinds of material difficulties. I mean, there are people who are working probably 60-hour weeks in difficult conditions, don't have much money, are able to put on Hamlet or other tragedies or other a whole range of genres, which would be interesting to talk about. There are a few accounts left of how those difficulties were surmounted and the kind of creative networks that were mobilized a world of mutual support comes to light in that where you're doing things like borrowing costumes or sets. And then on the other hand, those performances would happen in pubs a lot of the time or in democratic chapels, as they were called, in Chartist meeting rooms, some of which were quite large, maybe between 500 and 1,000 people. A few of those actually happened in commercial venues like the Western Amphitheater, which is said to seat 3,000 people. And it was played, Hamlet played before packed audiences there. So thousands and thousands of people were seeing this play. But then on the other hand, and just a significant part of the story is, especially in London and to some degree in Manchester, plays were being performed at the commercial houses that Chartist groups, local groups would go approach working class mostly, but popular theaters and see if they could have a benefit night. And these are some of the most important theaters in early to mid 19th century Britain, like the Victoria, which is still around as the old Vic, or the Surrey or the Standard in the East End, but these theaters in working class neighborhoods. And that has really not been a part of theater history before. And the theaters were navigating all sorts of legal regulations, not just about what kinds of plays they could perform in terms of genre, but also in terms of theatrical censorship and the politics of plays. But that the houses were willing to open themselves to this radical movement is really a fascinating part of mid-Victorian theater, and one that needs to be better integrated in what we know about theater history. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about some of the specific plays that you include in this volume. The first one is Wat Tyler, which is by, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, but Robert Southey, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, which was written before Chartism. Why do you include that play in this volume?
So the Chartists kind of performed many plays that just were part of either a theatrical or a literary canon. And so this is one example of it. But Wat Tyler was one of the most performed plays. And it's a play with a remarkable history of its own in the history of democratic and mass politics. It was written at the time of the French Revolution in 1794 and really in support of the French Revolution at a time when it was kind of very dangerous to do so, when there was a real repression of British radicals who supported the aims of the revolution. So it wasn't published at that moment, but it was published in the 18-teens when there was an upsurge of social movements following the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And it's kind of a wonderful story. Southey had become a conservative and the poet laureate by the mid 1810s. And he was furious that it was published. It was printed by radical publishers and became a real part of a canon of underground literature. There previously had not been any known performances of this play. It was assumed to largely be a closet drama. It's quite cool to know that members of the Chartist movement kind of took it up as a staged piece at least half a dozen times in the 1830s and 40s.
I'm so fascinated by this idea that these are people who are staging a play written, you know, sort of 30, 40 years earlier by somebody who's now their political opponent. Did it bother them that Southey had become a conservative, or did they sort of relish the fact that they were kind of throwing his youthful radicalism in his face?
Oh, definitely they relished it. I mean, and especially the kind of original publication context relished it. There would be kind of wonderful epigraphs of Southey on the title pages, like, you know, where art thou fled your youthful self, or something along those lines, and maybe kind of paraphrasing it maybe a little badly, but kind of pointing out the discrepancy, or reviews of it would kind of say, you know, Southey is we now know that he was only going over to the other side as a spy and to report upon them, because how would he, you know, listen to what he says about royalty and the pomps of court in this. And then quote some of the play. Actually, in Parliament, left-wing or reforming parliamentarian kind of had in his pocket, in his two pockets, Wat Tyler, and then in the other pocket, a recent article in the Tory Quarterly Review by Southey, and he quoted both of them in the speech and kind of going back and forth. So they had great fun with that. At the same time, Chartism was kind of so happy to assimilate kind of anything that they could use into their cultural world, and oftentimes it kind of didn't bother them too much if the political stance of contemporary authors in what they republished. They kind of had a faith in their readers that they would make sense of and could read those works critically.
One of the things that I found particularly interesting about Wat Tyler is that the critique of the monarchy is very much like a class critique. It's based on Wat Tyler's experience of being, you know, overtaxed and living in poverty. Is that sort of one of the things that would have drawn a Chartist audience to the play, that it's a kind of political and economic critique kind of hand in hand?
Absolutely. It was really an inseparable part of the movement was an economic agenda, and it was why the movement was feared. Just kind of immeasurable class differences in the 1830s and 1840s between the gigantic portion of ordinary people and a quite small sliver of who is the enfranchised class. There's also an anti-militarism in the play that spoke to the Chartist commitments. There was a real side of the movement that was pacifist and that kind of wanted to resist the forming of militias, that criticized various colonial wars that were going on, especially in China, the First Opium War, and in Afghanistan, the First British Afghan War. There's a couple in the 19th century, and of course later. It's also the play is about a strike, and kind of it's about the Peasants' Revolt, what's commonly called the Peasants' Revolt, but maybe better named the Great Rising of 1381. And so it spoke to Chartists' wish to construct a genealogy for themselves and a kind of history from below so much of Chartist culture was about a kind of elaborate public dinners where there would be an evening of toasting and kind of all the great heroes of the past would get toasted. Really fascinatingly, though, the play was actually performed right in the wake of a general strike that happened in 1842, the largest strike wave in Britain in the 19th century. In across the coal districts and the cotton districts happened in the late summer and early fall of 1842. Wat Tyler's kind of performed in the wake of that. So the kind of political economic linkage is certainly a deep resonance.
That's, as an American, that always strikes me about British culture, that there's just such a long historical memory, that these are events that are taking place 500 years earlier. And you read the play and you kind of get the sense that the author assumes that everyone watching it will at least know the kind of bare outlines of this rising, right?
Yeah. And I mean, there's a real tradition of radical history. I mean, Thomas Paine makes Wat Tyler a matter of dispute after kind of Edmund Burke disparages him in their debates about the French Revolution. There are essentially a number of titles like People's Edition. So, I mean, it just sounds like Howard Zinn of people's history of something, but there are lots of people's editions. And I should point out that radical accounts were very often the mass media accounts. Thomas Paine's Rights of Man sells more than any other book of its day. The radical press in the 30s and 40s, the Northern Star is the best selling or at least most read newspaper in England for a couple of years. And they're kind of disclosing the possibility of mass media markets to others. So definitely the audiences would have some understanding. There was occasionally kind of didactic functions or where you might have a lecture on Wat Tyler that precedes the play, or it might take place kind of at an end of a banquet, a theatrical production, and in that banquet there'd be other toasts and the like, other kinds of performances.
You really get the sense that it's a movement that valued oratory very highly and the spoken word very highly, even in non-theatrical contexts.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Some critics have alleged that Wat Tyler in particular would be difficult to stage. And it certainly would have been difficult to stage in professional houses because of theatrical censorship. But some critics have said also it's a play made up of political speeches, and that doesn't necessarily make for very good drama. But it might challenge what we think of as drama. And for Chartist audiences, it did seem to be good drama. Another play that they performed, The Trial of Robert Emmet, after the executed Irish rebel who led a rising in Dublin in 1803, the kind of set piece was Emmet's final address to the court, and just a long but incredibly moving piece, and it accounts of audiences' reactions are really extraordinary, as you know, the audience is kind of reduced to tears by the young Chartists embodying Emmet.
That seems, from our kind of contemporary vantage point, one of the most admirable things about the Chartist movement is their internationalism and the way that they kind of forge solidarity between English and Irish working class people. But also, you know, you mentioned their opposition to wars in China and Afghanistan. How did plays like The Trial of Robert Emmet kind of help to forge those effective bonds?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and I really agree that it is a kind of really admirable aspect of the Chartist movement when we in our age of kind of right wing populism and kind of xenophobia, which obviously has made a lot of inroads among working people in Britain and the United States. The Chartists were kind of confounded by how to forge alliances with the Irish, who had kind of their own traditions of rebellion, of course. A political leader, Daniel O'Connell, was a, who had, had won Catholic emancipation, so the right for Catholics to vote and hold office, and so kind of known as the liberator, but he was kind of an anti-radical and definitely kind of anti-Chartist, anti-trade unionist, and so kind of his imprint made it a real challenge and kind of a domain of cultural struggle. But The Trial of Robert Emmet is the most performed Chartist play. It was performed in localities that had significant populations of Irish immigrants. There are actually advertisements of the play that I found from newspapers and that are kind of clearly pointed at the Irish people. So there's an advertisement that says, "Arise, ye sons of Erin, your patriots are gone." So it was certainly kind of imagined in those terms. On the other hand, the kind of romantic martyr who sacrifices himself as a young person for the movement and dies for his beliefs, what was a very compelling story for all Chartists, where it was a movement that faced repeated persecution. It had a set of leaders sentenced to death after the Newport Rising, though they were spared execution, their sentences were reprieved to a life in penal transportation, sent to the prison colonies in Australia. But it had kind of many members who were jailed or transported. So kind of stories of political victimization and repression became kind of widely important. And many of the plays kind of support a European internationalism. William Tell is frequently staged. Wallace, the Hero of Scotland, is the name of a William Wallace play by William Barrymore, but that stage, there's plays about the French Revolution that get staged, and so a kind of we see a kind of trans-European internationalism in the Chartist movement. It doesn't enter on stage so much the anti-imperialism, except in terms of Ireland, which it was an essential part of the empire and certainly one of the most kind of important battlegrounds around the empire in terms of the metropolitan world.
And there aren't actually any versions of any scripts of The Trial of Robert Emmet that were performed, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was never published as a play, and it was never published as a play. And so what this volume includes is a prose version of the trial that was widely circulating. And the prose versions do look pretty close to a script in a lot of ways. I mean, transcripts of a trial include testimony of witnesses, speeches by the attorneys, a closing speech by the defendant, and a lot of direct discourse. So I think it gives us a pretty good sense of what the plays would have looked like. That does have to remain to a certain extent a mystery. Though we do know from accounts of the trial several of the aspects of performance, such as the fact that they tried to reenact the trial in kind of all its pomp and circumstance with a platoon of soldiers bringing Emmet in and him wearing chains and appearing before a judge, and then certainly the final speech of Emmet kind of taking front and center in all the performances.
Yeah, certainly there is an element of theatricality in any trial, so it's very easy to imagine how this would translate. It's almost an early example of documentary theater.
Yeah, there were something like 50 plays about Robert Emmet in the 19th and 20th century, plays and movies, Dion. Dionysus Boucicault writes a famous version. And then he writes The Old Lady Says No, is this kind of expressionist play from the early 20th century about Robert Emmet. So a number of playwrights recognized its theatricality, the theatricality of any trial, but then also the poignancy of this person that knows he's facing a certain death. The Emmett Robert Emmett was kind of immortalized in part because of his relationship with Sarah Curran, a woman he was engaged to. It seems that he didn't flee in part, but because of that relationship. And so their doomed romance becomes a large part of the story. Interestingly, unlike almost all the other theatrical versions, that doesn't feature in the Curtis version at all. It's really the politics of the case. And one can make the argument that Emmett was sticking around Dublin because he thought another rising might be imminent, and not just because of his romance.
Yeah, I love the way that these plays kind of upset all of these conventional assumptions we have about what type of people like what type of plays, that these are, you know, working class people in kind of a mass movement context watching plays where they say, no, we don't need a love story, just give us the politics, right? Give it to us straight, right? That's what they're there for. They want the speeches and they want the oratory and they want the passionate argument.
Yeah, and three of the four plays are in verse, so kind of want this elevated language and kind of elevated claims. So one of the verse plays is really a Gothic melodrama, closer to certain of our ideas about Victorian popular drama. Though Shakespeare, honestly, there are accounts of Shakespeare plays at the legitimate theater where the pit and the gallery sites where relatively lower class people would be sitting being full and the boxes being sparsely attended. Mm.
The play John Frost actually narrates the events of the Newport Rising, which is kind of an event that seems to hang over some of the other plays in a kind of subtextual way. Could you kind of talk about how that play presents those events and kind of what's the perspective that it takes?
Yeah, so the Newport Rising is this crucial turning point in British political history, certainly in the history of the movement of the Chartists. It's the last mass rising in British history. As I mentioned, it's actually also the last mass treason trial results from it. Two dozen Chartists are tried. The rising was an event in which 8,000 to 10,000 armed coal miners descended on this coal port town of Newport, Wales, in the early morning hours, likely to kind of signal to declare a Welsh Republic and signal kind of the beginning of the national of a national rising, but kind of things go terribly wrong. From kind of happenstances of weather and failures of different groups of Chartists to meet up. It ends in a confrontation with really a small detachment of soldiers who kill about two dozen Chartists and injure maybe 200 more. And then the rising kind of quickly dissolves. it's an important turning point in the history of Chartism, because there had been kind of certain ideas about the role that political violence might play, that armed revolution could play. There had been ideas that the British military would never fire on British civilians, and that that the people could kind of easily rise. Those are revealed in part as naive. And so kind of moderating influences become somewhat ascendant in the movement, who say we have to seek other paths. So, though it's very complicated, and there will be supporting a general strike in 1842 is trying to precipitate probably another revolutionary kind of situation. But at any rate, in that context, John Watkins writes this play called John Frost, a Chartist play in five acts. And it tells the story of the rising through one of the three leaders and one of the three Chartists sentenced to death. And it kind of tells it as a tragedy, a really kind of interesting tragedy, because it's almost an aborted tragedy. By the end, Frost is in a prison cell alone, and he almost kind of longs for the culmination of a tragedy, but here he's reprieved and is going to be sent to penal transportation, to a kind of living death, and a death that doesn't end in prison. And so he doesn't even get to suffer the fate of the tragic hero and martyr. But remarkably, Watkins is at this point in his career, at least, on the extreme left of the Chartist movement. And this play, is a brief in support of physical force, and it really defends the rising at a time when it is kind of dangerous to do so. Another real fascinating aspect of Chartist drama is it allowed discussion of ideas that would be dangerous if voiced in speeches or in print, but the dramatic element provided a certain kind of legal protection. It struggles with that. It's difficult to make of the Newport Rising an example of where armed rebellion might work, but it kind of wrestles with the failure of the rising tries to think kind of what might be the way forward in the wake of the wave of repression the Chartists suffered after Newport.
You mentioned the author being on kind of the far left wing of Chartism, and there's even a fascinating discussion between him and a socialist, where the socialist is saying, you know, your charter is never going to work, we need to overthrow the whole system, and the Frost character kind of responds, well, what we're going to do is get the suffrage today, and then we'll build socialism tomorrow, right? There's a very close connection between those ideas, at least in that scene.
Yeah, and so Owenite socialism is a really important strand in British politics, especially earlier in the 1830s, but really continuing, from utopian communities to efforts at forming a general union that are quite massive, to experiments in having different kinds of exchanges that circumvent money and try to have fair labor exchanges. And so just a kind of a real percolating up of different political experiments in the context of Owenite socialism. In the Chartist movement, Chartism kind of becomes this omnibus movement that takes on many different strands of radicalism. And so while it kind of typically, the leadership kind of doesn't express a support for socialism per se, kind of in local organizations and local activists, there's a huge crossover between the two movements. And so the play has this kind of set of allegorical figures who discuss with Frost what would be alternative ways of achieving social reform. There's a teetotaler, someone who preaches abstinence from alcohol. There's an Owenite socialist, and then there's a kind of Whig moderate. John Frost kind of makes common cause with the first two, and scorns the moderate, who many Chartists had felt had betrayed the hope of reform when, after a certain expansion of suffrage in the Reform Bill of 1832, they had kind of closed the door on further reform.
Great, yeah. And then finally, could you talk about the last play in the volume, St. John's Eve, which is the kind of to my eyes, quite bizarre Gothic romance with some radical left undertones?
Yeah, this is the only extant play by the important Chartist the writer and politician Ernest Jones, students of British history might be interested in it. For that, he wrote a kind of huge amount of poetry and some novels, published kind of many newspapers. But he kind of in his early days, what he wanted very much was to be a playwright. And he had wrote about half a dozen plays that he tried to get placed at various theaters. Actually, St. John's Eve was placed at two different theaters, or it might have been this and another one were placed at theaters, but both of them happened to fail before they came to the stage. He's a kind of gentleman radical and a late convert to Chartism, and so this comes out in his literary journal that he publishes called The Laborer, and it appears serially in that over a couple of issues. It is, as you say, this kind of Gothic melodrama where there's a kind of Mephistophelian figure who's trying to seduce the young hero from fidelity to his or from more belief in the heroine. But what's kind of quite interesting, and this is characteristic of a lot of Jones's other work, is that the male hero might not be that much better for the heroine than the Mephistopheles figure. The promise of male rescue it maybe doesn't bode that well. So it has a kind of fascinating gender politics, and gender politics that are different than a lot of melodrama, and certainly that's different than much of the explicit rhetoric in the Chartist movement, which can be very masculinist, even though there are thousands of women who participate, there's still a kind of image, self-image of Chartism as a kind of heroic masculinity, rescuing women from the degradations of social austerity and the factory and the like. Though they're staging plays that really complicate that image. Like there's Othello gets staged by the Chartists, and actually a fundraiser for the wives of the victims, so for families of political prisoners. But I kind of taken aback when you see that pairing of a Othello as a play for the wives.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would make that programming decision if I were in charge of that benefit. Well, Greg Vargo, thanks so much for talking with me about this fascinating book. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you about it, and it was great to read your very informative introduction and these plays that I don't think I would have ever encountered anywhere else. So it was a real treat.
Yeah, well, thanks for talking to me today.